Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega. Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway. And we begin today with the ongoing crisis in Puerto Rico. On Monday, the Senate voted down a series of bills that would have provided Puerto Rico with $600 million for disaster relief. Both political parties have been quick to assign blame. Here's Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont speaking on the Senate floor days before the vote.
The president is willing to endanger the entire disaster package for all of the United States because he wants to pick winners and losers. When there's a disaster, there are no winners and losers. Americans come together to help everybody.
And in a press release on Monday, Republican Senator Marco Rubio wrote, "My colleagues had the opportunity to choose action over obstruction. Shamefully, Senate Democrats said no." Republicans said that an aid package passed by the House doesn't give enough money to Midwestern farmers hit by recent floods. And Democrats argue that legislation favored by the GOP doesn't come close to meeting Puerto Ricans' needs. Amid the stalemate, the president on Tuesday lashed out at Puerto Rico, saying the island's politicians are, quote, grossly incompetent, spend the money foolishly or corruptly, and only take from the USA. And as the president tries to draw a line between Puerto Rico and the mainland United States, debates over Puerto Rican statehood are re-entering the conversation. Joining us now are Danica Cotto, a reporter for the Associated Press, and Andrea Gonzalez Ramirez, a senior news and politics writer for Refinery 29. Danica, Andrea, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
So, Danica, let's get started with you. What was the bill that failed supposed to address?
The main point of the bill, at least for Puerto Rico, was supposed to give the U.S. territory $600 million for its food stamp program. Unlike U.S. states, Puerto Rico receives food assistance as a block grant. So Congress actually has to approve disaster funding for the U.S. territory if needed, which it did. Back in November 2017, roughly 2 months after Hurricane Maria struck, it authorized a one-time $1.27 billion infusion for the nutritional assistance program. This was in addition to the $1.9 billion the island already receives annually from the federal government. But that money ran out in March, and back in November 2018, the governor had already requested the additional $600 million. Now, Trump has said he supports that amount of money, but he does not support any more, you know, generous disaster aid funding. And of course, the bill has since stalled in Congress.
And so when Congress failed to pass the bill, Danica, what kind of impact is this fund, is this lack of funding going to have on Puerto Ricans? Because we've already, I mean, even the initial food deliveries that were being made were, shall we say, lacking in nutritional value. And so now we're dealing with a food stamp crisis. What impact is this going to have immediately?
Well, I mean, the impact is already happening. The money, you know, ran out in March 1st, and that's been more than a month ago. And people have already seen a cut to their benefits. The people I've interviewed said they received half of their benefits. So, for example, a woman who was receiving $400 a month is now receiving $200, and she says she cannot afford to buy one of two types of insulin for her mother. She's also cut back greatly on fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's important to note that overall, the one-time infusion allowed the government to welcome another 279,000 people into the program who are below the poverty level. So overall, 44% of Puerto Rico's 3.2 million inhabitants live below the poverty line. And that's compared to a national average of about 14%.
Andrea, I want to bring you in here because my sense is that Puerto Rico in various points in our history has been important and not important, depending on where we stand.
Yeah.
I'm sensing that this is being framed as a partisan issue. It feels like it's a little bit of political football. What is your sense of how the framing right now is happening in Congress?
Oh, it's definitely a political football. I think after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico has been propped as this avatar for the Trump administration failures, right? We have them talking about how this was like, you know, a moral failure. So it's definitely this partisan thing in many ways. And historically, what we've seen is that neither party really cares about Puerto Rico, right? Both administrations, the Obama administration and the Trump administration, have done things to the island that are questionable and that have this hint of colonialism all the time. So it does feel like a political football. And at the end of the day, the people who are being the most impacted do not really have a say. Puerto Ricans do not have a representative that can vote in Congress. We're talking about the people of Puerto Rico without the people of Puerto Rico being in the conversation. Right. And that's something that's happened for the last 121 years.
Well, and now we're talking on something we've talked about for quite some time now about the potential for making Puerto Rico a state. And we know that this has been an ongoing conversation mm-hmm. with between the United States and Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans themselves. How likely is it to gain traction right now, this call for statehood, which among Puerto Ricans, which, you know, because it seems to be gaining traction in the media. It seems to be gaining mm-hmm. traction among certain politicians. So what do Puerto Ricans think right now?
I do think that definitely the pro-statehood party is winning the media conversation, right? Like, I think Governor Ricardo Rosselló has done an excellent job of, like, delivering his agenda and his message and talking about, like, how it boils down to inequality. But when it comes to the actual people on the island, this has been a divisive issue for decades, right? Throughout all my life, we've been having this conversation, and my parents' life and my grandparents' life. So there's definitely a tension there. I do feel that this effort, this last bill that was introduced that would give Puerto Rico statehood, it's questionable at best. Puerto Rico has had several referendums that have been non-binding. So that means that the results, like, Congress can ignore them, and they have. So what we're seeing now is this push to make Puerto Rico a state without actually considering the input of Puerto Ricans. It presents the question of what would this mean, and I don't think that has been addressed. And just to make Puerto Rico a state without asking Puerto Ricans whether they want to be a state, you know, it's the stench of the colony once again floating around. And I don't know if people on the island are going to be happy with that.
Well, let's talk to you, Danica, about that, because you're there on the island. I want to ask you a couple questions here. When it comes to the issue of statehood, what are Puerto Ricans talking about on the island?
I mean, certainly, I think Maria pushed some people who mm-hmm. might have been, you know, wavering between the current political status or statehood. It might have pushed some people towards statehood just because, you know, of the need for more help. Currently, there's a lot of inequalities. Puerto Rico does not receive the same amount of funding, even though in some cases they do pay the same taxes. So there's certainly, you know, inequality. And some people feel that it would be resolved by statehood. But there's been a five total referendums on the issue, all non-binding. The last one was held in June 2017. And the governor likes to say this is the definitive one. You know, people voted for statehood, which they did. It was more than 500,000 who voted for statehood, followed by nearly 7,800 votes for free association and independence, and then 6,800 votes for the current territorial status. But that referendum was hit by a boycott. Voter turnout was just 23%, which is the lowest ever. So that raised questions about the vote's legitimacy. But at least people here on the island feel that the most recent proposal from Representative Darren Soto is a bit unrealistic. I mean, you know, calls for statehood in 90 days. And like Andrea said, you know, it's sort of a rush job. People are not really being asked their opinion. And so, you know, Puerto Ricans are bristling at that. I feel, you know, Puerto Ricans do want to have this conversation, but they want to have the time to have it. They want to have a proper ballot. Whatever party is ruling in Puerto Rico, the ballot depends on, you know, what kind of wording they want to use. So there's never been sort of a yes or no. But there's been several new parties that are popping up. And the fact that the main opposition party, which originally supported the current territorial status, it's been losing steam. You know, a lot of people have left the party or it's been fractured. There's been candidates that have formed new parties, and those are still, you know, in formation. So the conversation is definitely there. People, I think, are very much, as Andrea said, eager. I mean, generation after generation. I mean, this is what dominates conversations in Puerto Rico. But they want to be able to have that conversation here and not, you know, have it with politicians in the U.S.
And speaking of politicians in the U.S., Andrea, we saw a group of Congress people on Monday, which included Senator Elizabeth Warren, send a letter stating that Puerto Rico's debt must be absolved. Now, is that real? I mean, we know Warren has a serious policy agenda, probably one of the wonkiest of the candidates right now.
Yeah, she does.
Is this a real policy proposal, or is it more politicking from the Democrats?
It does feel to an extent as more politics from the Democrats, you know. In 2016, we saw the PROMESA bill, which created a fiscal control board for Puerto Rico to address its debt crisis. This is a board of like 7 or 8 people who are unelected. They're appointed by the president. And there's been a lot of tension in the island about what this means, right? They're passing a lot of austerity measures. They targeted institutions such as the University of Puerto Rico, which is the biggest public education college system in the island. It services a lot of people. 3 years ago, they voted for PROMESA, and now they want to suddenly like change completely the conversation about the debt crisis. It makes me feel a little bit like this seems opportunistic. It seems like now it is, you know, valuable for them to hold up Puerto Rico. It's like, oh yeah, we're doing good things for them. Like, it's just for us to, you know, deal with the debt crisis in like this manner, and you know, deal with Dos Maria, like Puerto Rico, in this manner. When in reality, like just a couple of years ago, the conversation was completely different without really asking them, you know, if this was the way that they wanted to address the debt crisis.
Danica, I want to pivot here to the president. Of course, it's hard to ignore the tweets that President Trump issued this week, including making a statement that giving more aid to Puerto Rico would, quote, take dollars away from our farmers and so many others. The takeaway, we're down in Puerto Rico. I know Puerto Ricans are farmers as well, has a very robust agricultural community. What are they saying about what the president has said?
Well, like the governor said, and, you know, in reply to President Trump's tweets, that, you know, Puerto Rican farmers are U.S. farmers, and a lot of people bristle and are still annoyed at the notion that many feel that don't know that Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, and the people who live here are U.S. citizens. They're not allowed to vote in the presidential elections, but they are allowed to vote in primaries. And again, they are U.S. citizens. So they're not surprised by Trump's comments. It still, you know, sparks a lot of anger among people here. They agree, obviously, that corruption has been prevalent for decades, but they also know, you know, that starting this month, Puerto Rico will no longer have to wait for approval from FEMA before issuing reimbursements related to the hurricane. So there's just this sense of, why are you dragging us through the mud? You know, we're U.S. citizens. We need help. I mean, Hurricane Maria hit nearly 2 years ago, and there's still, you know, people living under blue tarps. There's still people struggling to find jobs. Although the tweets are not surprising to many, it still, I feel like, hurts many, especially those who are struggling, and especially those who are in the food assistance program who have seen a cut in their benefits.
Danica Cotto is a reporter for the Associated Press, and Andrea Gonzalez Ramirez is a senior news and politics writer for Refinery 29. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Asking about reparations for slavery has become a standard question for Democratic presidential candidates ahead of 2020, and it's left many candidates scrambling to respond.
I propose a $100 billion plan of reparations.
If it means just a cash payment or a check to families, I would not support that.
What I do find challenging is the best way to do that, how to ensure that it's fair.
People aren't starting out on the same base. We have got to give people a lift up.
The debate around whether or not to fund reparations for Black Americans goes far beyond being a political talking point. For Maxine Crump, a descendant of slaves, the definition of what reparations are is clear.
It's a repayment for what has been owed.
Crump is a descendant of slaves sold by Georgetown University in 1838, and she's the president and CEO of Dialogue on Race Louisiana. We sat down for a conversation about reparations in the United States, what they could look like, and what it would take to make them a reality. Also with us was Catherine Franke of Columbia University, author of the forthcoming book Repair, Redeeming the Promise of Abolition, and Nikichi Taifa, an attorney and founding member of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. I asked Maxine first to reflect on the legacy of slavery and how it should inform the conversation.
So when I look at the fact that our lineage goes back before the United States was a country, and realize that hundreds of years of enslavement being treated as chattel, the use of their bodies and labor, and all of that was used to enrich the country and much that followed today. This country sustains its wealth from those people, and that included my ancestors. We are born of America. We are America's people. This is our homeland. And for America to disenfranchise those who were enslaved, the former enslaved, and its descendants, and allow many of the atrocities that have descended from then, that have continued, and how we tolerate that and let it be okay is what I think about when I think about this conversation of reparation.
Nikichi, when we talk about the objectives of reparations, what are those in your view?
Well, I would say that in the context of Black people in the United States, the quest for reparations essentially constitutes four elements. Number one, the formal acknowledgement that there was a historical wrong and an official unfettered apology for the dehumanization and the atrocities of the enslavement era and beyond. Number two, the recognition that the injury has continued throughout the years and it still manifests today. Number three, the commitment to redress by the federal government, which sanctioned the enslavement and subsequent segregation, by corporate entities, by private institutions, by religious groups, by academic institutions, etc., which enjoyed unjust enrichment from the era. And then number four, the actual compensation in whatever form or forms are agreed upon. And that's the essential catch-all. What is agreed upon between the agreed parties and the entities that will be compensating?
I want to bring in Catherine here. Why are we talking about reparations in the mainstream again today? What is it that through history has brought this back up for Americans periodically?
Well, it's an interesting question of why this issue has gotten traction now. I think we could say the same thing about Me Too. We could say the same thing about Black Lives Matter. These deep wounds in the U.S. culture have been festering for a very long time, and then suddenly it seems like they get traction. And I think in some ways the fact that it's gotten traction now is a symptom or an effect of the Trump administration, where we see racism in its rawest form, unhindered by any kind of attempt to blunt it. The accumulated weight of our failure to face this problem is in some way the result of why we have Trump in the White House now. And I think it makes this discussion that much more pressing and one that we just can't turn away from anymore.
Nikichi, I would love for you to weigh in on that, what Catherine just said, because I know you've been doing a lot of work within the Beltway, if you will, within D.C. So tell me a little bit about how this reparations issue has, how far it's gotten or how far it hasn't gotten in Washington.
Yes. Well, first of all, I just want to say I've been organizing around the issue of reparations since 1975, actually, at a time when the topic was not popular. It was definitely on the fringes. It was not fashionable. But one of the things that's important to recognize is that this is not new, okay? In 1987, in this country, legislation was passed authorizing the payment of $20,000 to each Japanese American detention camp survivor, a $1.5 million trust fund to be used to educate Americans about the suffering of the Japanese Americans, a formal apology from the United States government, and a pardon to all of those who resisted detention camp internment. It is a sad commentary that the United States government has not taken responsibility for its role in the enslavement era or post-slavery segregation and all of the discriminatory policies that we see today, whether it's in healthcare or education or the criminal punishment system. I will say that in 2009, the Senate passed an apology bill, but it contained a disclaimer that those seeking compensation could not use that apology to support a legal claim against the United States. So that's why when I talk about the essential elements of reparations, I say an unfettered apology, an apology that doesn't come with any chains or any strings.
If I can add to the important history that Nikichi's just given us, I would push it back even into the end of the Civil War. at that point, as the Northern military was moving through the South and liberating people that had been held in slavery across the South, Northern military officials recognized that some kind of reparation must be given to freed people, both to compensate them for their stolen labor, but also to recognize the horror of enslavement itself. There was also this sense that if you just liberate people into abject poverty, they will be locked into a kind of intergenerational poverty that they'll never escape from, and that's exactly what we've seen. So one of the leading generals at that time, General Saxton, who was working in the Sea Islands in Georgia and North and South Carolina, he led an effort to get land to freed people in what we are now familiar with in units of 40 acres and a mule as reparations. And those reparations were made. Land was transferred. And then once President Lincoln was assassinated, the new President Johnson took all that land away and gave it back to the people who had previously owned black people. It's just outrageous. So it's time we came back to this, not just to the movement of the 70s and the 80s, which is hugely important, but to what was a widely viewed moral imperative in the 1860s.
And one of this, we're talking about, financial and economic implications of one of the biggest moral failings that this country has ever had. And then the pushback to one solution here seems to be, it would be impossible to have reparations. We can't give everybody a check. That seems to be a big pushback, or at least a talking point. Nikichi, what's your response to people who say it's just impossible to implement any kind of reparations?
Well, I would say absolutely nothing is impossible. Where there is a will, there is a way. But one of the things that's critical to understand is that reparations is not just about a check. It's not just about money. Reparations is about repair. It's about amends. And a reparations settlement can come in as many forms as necessary to equitably address the many forms of injury sustained from chattel slavery and its continued vestiges. And, some of those forms, it can, in fact, and could and should include cash payments, but it can also include land or economic development or funds for scholarships and community development. I mean, they could involve education or multimedia depictions of African Americans and textbooks that teach correct history, development of historical monuments and museums. It can be the elimination of discriminatory laws and practices, many of which are found within the criminal punishment system, all of the infringements on voting rights. So reparations can be very broad, but the important thing is it's not what the perpetrator says it's going to be. It's what the victims themselves come up with. And that's why a commission is so important, or some type of collaborative, unifying, broad-based initiative where African-Americans, descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States can come together and decide, well, just what should it look like?
Tanzina, I would like to speak to that as well. This is Maxine. Anybody can step up and look at something and look at it as impossible. Nikichi indicated that there is a way to do this without major disruption if we sit down and strategize. But it's, again, if we know enough. I think that those who are fighting against this change is because they're going with the common narrative that black people are somehow something that isn't fully American, which was the way that the narrative was formed to say, these are not quite fully human. They're supposed to be mastered. They don't know how to run their own lives. So we're still not believed when we speak up. And it can't just be the voices of those who have been victimized, but they have to lead. And none of the movements that have made things better to the degree that they have been better for those who are descendants of slaves, it always came with other people recognizing it and other groups joining the movement to make a difference. And that can happen now. We do not have to have the major disruption. We're a major nation. We're the greatest nation, the most powerful nation, and the wealthiest nation. We certainly can come up with this strategy. And after all of the time that this reparation need has been in place, we are just now, this major country, just now talking about this as if what's new. It's new in the minds of people because it's able to go under the radar, and there are enough people who believe that this country still is entitled to belong to white people and let whites determine what else everyone else who's not white can have. And we don't say that out loud because it's considered insensitive, and yet it's insensitive to let this happen. If this isn't true, why are we still grouping people by color and asking them to check the box? And if this isn't true, why are the major leaders of this country and the major wealth in the hands of those who are white? It has to be something systemic that's supporting this.
And some of the hesitance you see among white people today around reparations is, why should we be writing checks to black people? Some of those people arrived in the United States recently. They weren't enslaved. I have no obligation to write a check. My parents didn't own slaves, or my great-grandparents didn't own slaves. And to them, and I hear those people a lot, I would say people like myself, we're on the radio, I'll tell you I'm white. White people have been the beneficiaries of white supremacy in all aspects of our lives, even if we or our ancestors never owned slaves. Just as I would say black people have been burdened by a badge of inferiority that attached to that concept of white supremacy, whether they had ancestors who were enslaved or not. And it's that collective reckoning with the ideology of white supremacy that made chattel slavery possible in the first place that I think we have to use as the way to frame reparations today. Someone like me, I'm winning a lottery, right? That I got born into a family that has intergenerational wealth because of white privilege. I have no entitlement to that money other than luck. So I think as a collective project, we should tax those estates and put that money into a trust. I feel like my family has been holding that money in a trust for people who were owed property and some kind of means as reparation at the end of slavery. So we can do this. We can do it in a collective way, and I think we have to.
Catherine, thank you for that. Nikeechi, the presidential candidates, or at least some of them for 2020, are already talking about this term, reparations. Julian Castro comes to mind. A couple of other folks have sort of brought this up. Do you hear this as talking points, Nikeechi, or do you hear this as real interest in finally getting to a solution around reparations?
Well, I think it might have started as talking points, but I think that it is blossoming into people really looking behind the rhetoric that they are saying. If the 2020 candidates don't do anything else, they and every member of Congress must endorse the passage of H.R. 40. Many of those who are running are currently in the Senate. There is no Senate companion bill to H.R. 40. That needs to be enacted as well. And I say the H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act, is the least common denominator.
One, I want to follow up on that, Nikeechi. What is it going to take to get the political will to make that happen? Because we can talk about getting it done. We can talk about all the reasons for getting it done. We can talk about, as Catherine said, the estate tax. There are baby bond proposals floating out there to help close the racial wealth gap. There's a million different proposals, but we need the political will. And do you see that happening?
Well, I will say that the issue of reparations in the United States was once in the not-too-distant past totally unthinkable by mainstream America as viable public policy. I think that is beginning to shift, and it's beginning to shift because the conversation is beginning to be had in the mainstream press. It's not on the fringes. It's beginning to be part of the conversation where it should have been all along.
Maxine, I'd like to end with you. What does our future look like if we do not address reparations, at least in a meaningful way? And are you hopeful that we will?
Oh, yes. I'm definitely hopeful. I don't have to think about what's going to happen if we don't do this, because we're going to do it. We need to become who we say we are in our founding document, the Constitution. So I'm not worried about whether reparation is going to happen. I just want it to happen, as Nikeechi said, in the best way possible, with everyone understanding it. And they're going to understand it when the education is proper. And I have a lot of hope for the future.
Maxine Crump is a descendant of slaves sold by Georgetown University in 1838, and is also the president and CEO of Dialogue on Race Louisiana. Catherine Franke is professor of law, gender, and sexuality studies at Columbia University, and author of the forthcoming book, Repair: Redeeming the Promise of Abolition. And Nikishi Taifa is an attorney and founding member of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. I'd like to thank you all for joining us in this conversation.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, y'all, you've been talking to us about this, so it's your turn.
Hi, my name is Tony. I'm calling from Franklin, Massachusetts. Yes, I think there should be reparations for slavery. African-American leaders should get together with other national leaders to decide how this will be settled. It's time to begin the process of making reparations for this great sin that our nation committed.
Hi, my name is Cree White. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I think they are owed. I think they should be paid out in the form of free education and also in land that was promised and never delivered. I hope it comes about in my lifetime. We saw our first black president. Maybe we'll see this as well.
My name is Michelle. I'm calling from Honolulu. The United States owes much to descendants of former slaves. How about ending housing discrimination in a real way? Better schools in black communities to bring them up to par with the best schools in white communities. I don't think just handing out cash payments will help pull people out of poverty. Repairs and maintenance to roads, buildings, and black neighborhoods should be a priority. We can do this, but are the powers that be willing to do so?
Carl Rice from Angola, New York. Slavery, or at least the results of slavery and the effects of it, have transferred to ghettos where it's not segregated necessarily anymore, but those people could still use a chance to get out because the town or municipality itself was affected in a way that people living there in the future, whether black or white, would have a hard time pursuing the American dream.
Reparations would only further divide this nation so late since the end of slavery. And what amount of money could possibly equal the amount of horror, degradation, abuse, and indignity suffered by slaves? It would never be enough to absolve our ancestors of their guilt. True reparations would be an actual equality lived rather than just empty written equality not realized in the form of human rights. This is Nikki Mohammed-Fawzi from Arlington, Texas.
Thanks, folks. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Hey, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
On Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell lost a vote to overhaul the confirmation process for federal court nominees. At the moment, 30 hours of debate time are required before a nominee can be confirmed. The rule change would have lowered that to just 2 hours. That would allow the Republican-led Senate to push through more of President Trump's judicial nominees. But even though McConnell's confirmation overhaul failed this week, Senate Republicans could still use the infamous nuclear option to push the measure through without 60 votes. Lawrence Hurley is a Supreme Court reporter for Reuters, and he's here to walk us through the Senate's rule change. Lawrence, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
Why is decreasing the amount of debate time important for Republicans? I mean, is this part of the broader strategy to stack the courts?
Yeah, I think for Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, his big priority is to get judges confirmed across the board, whether it be appeals courts, district courts, and of course the Supreme Court. And this is just another effort to try and get more of those judges through as quickly as possible, perhaps with an eye on the 2020 election and the concern that President Trump might not win re-election or that the Republicans might not keep control of the Senate.
Now, this essentially would change the amount of time that actual debate would be required before a nominee could be confirmed. Can you tell us the difference between what it is today and what McConnell is proposing?
Well, under the current Senate rules, there's a 30-hour period for debate after a motion for cloture, as they call it, is made. And so that would be cut down to 2 hours. I think in practice, a lot of the time in history, those 30 hours are not actually debated. It's not like there's a bunch of senators on the floor debating the merits of a particular nominee. It's more of a procedural thing. And so this just means that it kind of opens up the Senate floor to be pushed through more nominees, and maybe get them through quicker, get more of them through, and try to fill all these vacancies. There's currently 130 district court vacancies, and there's actually only 56 nominations pending. So part of this issue is the president not nominating people.
I'm a little dismayed to think about what you just said, that these folks are not using the entire 30 hours to perform these debates. But wouldn't that feels like a massive shift, though, Lawrence? I mean, how would this change the number of judges going through the system?
Well, a lot of it's to do with, you know, the White House actually nominating judges. And district court judges are a little different to the appeals court judges that we've heard a lot about recently, because Trump has had a record number of appeals court judges confirmed in his first 2 years. And, you know, appeals courts judges are very influential. They can really shape the law. And they're also more kind of political appointees in some ways. But district court nominees are usually less controversial. They're usually, even from states with Democratic senators, those senators will have a say in who gets nominated. And I think a lot of the time these debate rules are sort of waived, you know, just to get judges through, with bipartisan support. And so part of the complaint here from the Republicans, I guess, is that they just think that Democrats are needlessly obstructing non-controversial nominees as opposed to the ones who they really care about.
The measure failed in the Senate yesterday, but there's still a chance that it could get pushed through. How is that?
Yeah, so there was a procedural vote yesterday, which the Republicans lost, but now they can try and push through a straight sort of up or down vote, similar to what they did with the Supreme Court confirmation process, where they changed the rules to allow Neil Gorsuch to be confirmed.
You've been covering the courts for 15 years, Lawrence, and there are some people who call the number of vacancies a, quote, judicial emergency. Tell us more about that.
Well, it sort of varies different parts of the country, but there are some areas in the country where there have been vacancies for quite a long time. Some of those vacancies have not been filled basically because the Republicans refused to move forward with some of President Obama's nominees before he left office. And for the judiciary, obviously, all they care about is having these judgeships filled. They don't really care who fills them, especially at the district court level. So, you know, in some parts of the country, there are concerns about cases being heard. And, you know, that can really hold up the whole process.
We've been speaking with Lawrence Hurley, who reports on the federal court system for Reuters. Lawrence, thank you.
No worries. Thanks.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can always call us to share your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'll be on vacation tomorrow, but WNYC reporter Arun Venugopal will be filling in, so be sure to tune in. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.